Saturday, Disc 5.
When Grammaticus came out of mourning, more than 20 years ago, he began a series of love affairs that still continues. The pattern is well established. A younger woman, usually English, sometimes French, is taken on as secretary and housekeeper, and by degrees becomes a kind of wife. After 2 or 3 years, she'll walk out, unable to bear any more, and it will be her replacement who greets the Perrone family in late July. Rosalind is scathing at each turnaround, always preferring the last to the next, then, over time, developing a fondness. After all, it's hardly the new arrival's fault. The children, entirely without judgment, even as teenagers, are immediately kind to her. Perrone, constitutionally bound to love one woman all his life, has been quietly impressed, especially as the old man advances into his 70s. Perhaps he's slowing down at last. For Teresa, a jolly 40-year-old librarian from Brighton, has been with him almost 4 years. The dinners outside in the interminable dusk, the scented wheels of hay in the small, steep fields that surround the gardens, and the fainter smell of swimming pool chlorine on the children's skin and warm red wine from Cahors or Cabrières. It should be paradise. It almost is, which is why they continue to visit. But John can be a childish, domineering man, the sort of artist who grants himself the license of a full-spectrum mood swing. He can migrate in the space of a bottle of red wine from twinkly anecdotes to sudden eruption, then a huffy retreat to his study, that tall, stooping back retreating across the lawn in the gloom towards the lighted house, with Betty or Jane or Francine, and now Teresa following him in to smooth things out. He's never quite got the trick of conversation, tending to hear in dissenting views, however mild, a kind of affront, an invitation to mortal combat. The years and the drink are not softening him, and naturally, as he ages and writes less, he's become unhappier. His exile in France has been a prolonged sulk, darkened over 2 decades by various slights from the home country. There was a bad 4-year patch when his collected poems was out of print and another publisher had to be found. John minded when Spender and not he was knighted, when Rain, not Grammaticus, got the editorship of Faber, when he lost the Oxford professorship of poetry to Fenton, when Hughes and later Motion were preferred as poet's laureate, and above all, when it was Heaney who got the Nobel. These names mean nothing to Perrone. But he understands how eminent poets, like senior consultants, live in a watchful, jealous world in which reputations are edgily tended, and a man can be brought low by status anxiety. Poets, or at least this poet, are as earthbound as the rest. For a couple of summers, when the children were babies, the Perrones went elsewhere. But they found nothing in southern Europe as beautiful as Saint-Félix. It was where Rosalind spent her childhood holidays. The chateau was enormous, and it was easy to keep out of John's way. He liked to spend several hours a day alone. There were rarely more than 2 or 3 bad moments in a week, and with time, they've mattered less. And as the pattern of his love life became established, Rosalind has had her own delicate reasons to keep close contact with her father. The chateau belonged to her maternal grandparents, and was the love of her mother's life. She was the one who modernised and restored the place. The worry is that if age and illness wear John down into finally marrying one of his secretaries, the chateau could pass out of the family into the hands of a newcomer. French inheritance laws might have prevented that, but there's a document, an old tontine, to show that Saint-Félix has been exempted and that English law prevails. In his irritable way, John has assured his daughter he'll never remarry and that the chateau will be hers, but he refuses to put anything in writing. That background anxiety will probably be resolved. Another more forceful reason why they've kept up their summer visits to the chateau is because Daisy and Theo used to insist. Those were the old days, before John and Daisy fell out. They loved their grandfather and considered his silly moods proof of his difference, his greatness, a view he rather shared himself. He doted on them, never raised his voice against them, and hid from them his worst outbursts. From the beginning he considered himself, rightly as it turned out, a figure in their intellectual development. Once it became clear that Theo was never going to take more than a polite interest in books, John encouraged him at the piano and taught him a simple boogie in C. Then he bought him an acoustic guitar and lugged up from the cellars cardboard boxes of blues recordings on heavy old 78s as well as LPs, and made tapes which arrived in London in regular packages. On Theo's 14th birthday, his grandfather drove him to Toulouse to hear John Lee Hooker in one of his last appearances. One summer evening after dinner, Grammaticus and Theo performed St. James's Infirmary under a brilliant sky of stars, the old man tipping back his head and warbling in a husky American accent that made Rosalind tearful. Theo, still only 14, improvised a sweet and melancholy solo. Perrone, sitting apart with his wine by the pool, bare feet in the water, was touched too, and blamed himself for not taking his son's talent seriously enough. That autumn, Theo began travelling to East London for lessons with various elderly figures of the British blues scene, contacted through a friend of Rosalind's at her paper. According to Theo, Jack Bruce was the most impressive because he had formal training in music, played several instruments, revolutionised bass playing, knew everything about theory, and recorded with everyone during the heroic period of the British blues, in the early 60s, the long-ago days of Blues Incorporated. He was also, Theo said, more patient with him than the others, and very kind. Perrone was surprised how an elevated figure like Bruce could be troubled to spend time instructing a mere boy. Disarmingly, Theo saw nothing unusual in it at all. Through Bruce, Theo met some of the legendary figures. He was allowed to sit in on a Clapton masterclass. Long John Baldry came over from Canada for a reunion. Theo liked hearing about Cyril Davies and Alexis Corner, and the Graham Bond organisation and Cream's first concert. By some accident, Theo jammed for several minutes with Ronnie Wood and met his older brother, Art. A year on, Art asked Theo to join a jamming session at the Eel Pie Club in the Cabbage Patch pub in Twickenham. In less than 5 years, he seems to have possessed the whole tradition. Now, whenever he's at the chateau, he plays for his grandfather and shows him his latest tricks. He seems to need John's approval, and the old man obliges. Perrone has to hand it to him. He opened up something in Theo that he, Perrone, might never have known about. It's true that on a body surfing holiday in Pembrokeshire when Theo was 9, Henry showed him 3 simple chords on someone's guitar and how the blues worked in E. That was just one thing along with the frisbee throwing, grass skiing, quad biking, paintballing, stone skipping and inline skating. He worked seriously on his children's fun back then. He even broke an arm, keeping up on the skates. But he never could have guessed those 3 chords would become the basis of his son's professional life. John Grammaticus has also been a force in Daisy's life, at least until something went wrong between them. When she was 13, about the time he was teaching her brother the boogie in C, he asked her to tell him about the books she enjoyed. He heard her out and announced she was understretched. He was contemptuous of the young adult fiction she was reading. He persuaded her to try Jane Eyre and read the first chapters aloud to her and mapped out for her the pleasures to come. She persisted, but only to please him. The language was unfamiliar, the sentences long, the pictures in her head, she kept saying, wouldn't come clear. Perrone tried the book and had much the same experience. But John kept his granddaughter at it. And finally, 100 pages in, she fell for Jane and would hardly stop for meals. When the family went for a walk across the fields one afternoon, they left her with 41 pages to go. When they returned, they found her under a tree by the dovecote, weeping. not for the story, but because she had reached the end and emerged from a dream to grasp that it was all the creation of a woman she would never meet. She cried, she said, out of admiration, out of joy that such things could be made up. What sort of things, Grammaticus wanted to know. Oh, Grandad, when orphanage children die, yet weather is so beautiful. And that bit when Rochester pretends to be a gypsy, and when Jets meet Bertha for the first time, and she's like a wild animal. He gave her Kafka's Metamorphosis, which he said was ideal for a 13-year-old girl. She raced through this domestic fairy story and demanded her parents read it too. She came into their bedroom in the chateau far too early one morning and sat on the bed to lament. That poor Gregor Samsa. His family are so horrid to him. How lucky he was to have a sister to clean out his room and find him the foods he liked. Rosalind took it in at a gulp, as though it were a legal brief. Perrone, by nature ill-disposed towards a tale of impossible transformation, conceded that by the end he was intrigued. He wouldn't have put it higher than that. He liked the unthinking cruelty of that sister on the final page, riding the tram with her parents to the last stop, stretching her young limbs, ready to begin a sensual life. A transformation he could believe in. This was the first book Daisy recommended to him and marked the beginning of his literary education at her hands. Though he's been diligent over the years and tries to read almost everything she puts his way, he knows she thinks he's a coarse, unredeemable materialist. She thinks he lacks an imagination. Perhaps it's so, but she hasn't quite given up on him yet. The books are piled at his bedside, and she'll be arriving with more tonight. He hasn't even finished the Darwin biography, or started the Conrad. From the summer of Bronte and Kafka onwards, Grammaticus took charge of Daisy's reading. He had firm, old-fashioned views of the fundamentals, not all of which he thought should be too pleasurable. He believed in children learning by rote, and he was prepared to pay up. Shakespeare, Milton, and the King James Bible, £5 for every 20 lines memorized from the passages he marked. These three were the sources of all good English verse and prose. He instructed her to roll the syllables around her tongue and feel their rhythmic power. The summer of her 16th birthday, Daisy earned a teenage fortune at the chateau, chanting, even singing parts of Paradise Lost, and Genesis, and various gloomy musings of Hamlet. She recited Browning, Clough, Chesterton, and Masefield. In one good week, she earned £45. Even now, 6 years on at the age of 23, she claims to be able to spout her word non-stop for more than 2 hours. By the time she was 18 and leaving school, she'd read a decent fraction of what her grandfather called the obvious stuff. He wouldn't hear of her going anywhere to study English literature other than his own Oxford College. Though Henry and Rosalind begged him not to, he probably put in a good word for her. Dismissively, he told them that these days the system was incorruptible and he couldn't help even if he wanted to. Familiarity with their own professions told them this could never be strictly true, but it soothed their consciences. The handwritten note to Daisy's headmaster from a tutor which said she'd given a dazzling interview, backing every insight with a quotation. A year later, she may have had a little too much success for her grandfather's taste. She arrived at Saint-Félix 2 days after the rest of the family and brought with her the poem that had won her that year's Newdigate Prize. Henry and Rosalind had never heard of the Newdigate, but were automatically pleased. But it meant more, perhaps too much, to Daisy's grandfather, who had won it himself back in the late 50s. He took her pages into his study. Her parents were only allowed to see them later. The poem described at length the tender meditations of a young woman at the end of another affair. Once more she has stripped the sheets from her bed and taken them to the laundrette where she watches through the misted monocle of the washing machine all stains of us turning to be purged. These affairs also turned, like the seasons, too quickly, running green to brown, with windfalls sweetly rotting to oblivion. The stains are not really sins, but watermarks of ecstasy, or later, milky palimpsests, and therefore not so easily removed after all. Vaguely religious, mellifluously erotic, the poem suggested to a troubled Perrone that his daughter's first year at university had been more crowded than he could ever have guessed. Not just a boyfriend or a lover, but a whole succession to the point of serenity. This may have been why Grammaticus took against the poem. His protégé had struck out and found other men. Or it may have been one more pitiful attack of status anxiety. Informing Daisy's literary education, he hadn't intended to produce yet another rival poet. This Newdigate, after all, had also been won by Fenton and Motion. Teresa made a simple supper of salade niçoise with fresh tuna from the market in Pamiers. The dining table was set right outside the kitchen on the edge of a wide expanse of lawn. It was another unexceptionally beautiful evening, with purplish shadows of trees and shrubs advancing across the dried grass, and crickets beginning to take up where the afternoon cicadas left off. Grammaticus was last to appear, and Perrone's guess, as his father-in-law lowered himself into the chair next to Daisy's, was that he'd already sunk a bottle of wine or more on his own. This was confirmed when he laid his hand on his granddaughter's wrist and, with that hectoring frankness that drunks mistake for intimacy, told her that her poem was ill-advised and not the sort of thing that generally won the Newdigate. It wasn't good at all, he told her, as though she must know it already and was bound to agree. He was, as a psychiatrist might have said, disinhibited. As early as her final year at school, just 18, head girl and academic star of the sixth form, Daisy had developed her precise and self-contained manner. She's a light-boned young woman, trim and compact, with a small elfin face, short black hair and straight back. Her composure looks impregnable. At dinner that night, only her parents and brother knew how fragile that controlled appearance was. But she was cool as she unhurriedly withdrew her hand and looked at her grandfather, waiting for him to say more. He took a long pull on his wine, as though it was a pint pot of lukewarm beer, and advanced into her silence. He said the rhythms were loose and clumsy, the stanzas were of irregular length. Henry looked at Rosalind, willing her to intervene. If she didn't, he would have to, and the matter would assume too much importance. To his shame, he was not absolutely certain what a stanza was until he looked in a dictionary later that night. Rosalind held back, breaking into her father's flow too early could cause an explosion. Managing him was a delicate art. On her side of the table, Teresa was already suffering. In her time, and on many occasions in the years before her time, there had been scenes like this, though never one that involved the children. She knew it could not end well. Theo rested his jaw in his palm and stared at his plate. Encouraged by his granddaughter's silence, John went on a roll, warming to his own authority, stupidly affectionate in his manner. He was confusing the young woman in front of him with the 16-year-old whom he had coached in the Elizabethan poets of the Silver Age. If he'd ever known, he had forgotten what one good year at a university could do. He could only imagine she felt as he did, and he was only telling her the obvious. The poem was too long, it tried too hard to shock, there was a simile they both knew was convoluted. He paused to drink deeply again, and still she said nothing. Then he told her her poem was not original, and finally got a reaction. She cocked her neat head and raised an eyebrow. Not original. Perrone, seeing a telltale tremble in the dainty chin, thought the cool manner wouldn't hold. Rosalind spoke up at last, but her father talked over her. Yes, a little-known but gifted poet, Pat Jordan, a woman of the Liverpool school, had written up a similar idea in the 60s. The end of the affair, the spinning sheets at the laundrette displayed before the thoughtful poet. Was it possible that Grammaticus knew how idiotic his behaviour was, but could not pull back? In the old man's weak eyes, there was a dog-like, cringing look, as if he was scaring himself and was pleading for someone to restrain him. His voice cracked as he strained for affability, and he talked on and on, making himself more ridiculous. The silence around the table that had enabled him was now his punishment, his affliction. Theo was gazing at him in amazement, shaking his head. Of course, John was saying. He wasn't accusing Daisy of plagiarism. She may have read the poem and forgotten about it, or simply reinvented it for herself. After all, it wasn't such an exceptional or unusual idea. But either way... At last he wound down, unable to make his situation worse. Perrone was pleased to see that his daughter wasn't crushed. She was furious. He could see the pulse in her neck throbbing beneath the skin. But she was not going to relieve her grandfather with any sort of outburst. Suddenly, unable to bear the silence, he started up again, talking hurriedly, trying to soften his judgment without actually altering it. Daisy cut in and said she thought they should talk about something else, at which Grammaticus muttered a simple, "Oh, fuck!" stood up and went indoors. They watched him go, a familiar sight, that receding form, but upsetting too, for it was the first time that summer. Daisy stayed on another 3 days, long enough for her grandfather to have thought of ways of resuming relations. But the next day he was brisk and cheerfully self-absorbed and seemed to have forgotten. Or he was simply pretending. Like many drinkers, he liked to think each new day drew a line under the day before. When Daisy left for Barcelona, it was an arrangement that had long been in place. She brought herself to kiss him goodbye on both cheeks, and he gripped her arm, and afterwards was able to persuade himself that a reconciliation had taken place. When Rosalind and then Henry tried to convince him that he still had work to do on Daisy, he told them they were making trouble. He must have wondered then why she didn't appear at Saint Félix the following 2 summers. She found good reasons to travel with friends in China and Brazil. He should have written to her when she got her first, but by then he had fallen into a sulk about the matter. So it was a risky move when Rosalind sent him a proof copy of Daisy's poems. Wasn't he bound to dislike them? Especially when her publisher was the one who let his collected go out of print. If his enthusiasm for My Saucy Bark was tactical, he concealed it brilliantly. His long letter to her opened by conceding he had been a disgraceful boor about the laundrette poem. It wasn't included in the book, and Henry wondered, though never aloud, whether she thought her grandfather was right about it all along. She had found a conversational tone, he told her in his letter, that was nevertheless rich with meaning and association. Every now and then that everyday level voice was interrupted by lines of sudden emotional intensity and secular transcendence. In this respect, he found everywhere in her poems the spirit of his beloved Larkin, but invigorated by a young woman's sensuality and darker humour. In his near-illegible longhand, he praised the intellectual muscle, the courage of hard and independent thinking that informed the scheme of her poems. He loved the slatternly wit of her 6 short songs. He said he laughed like an idiot at the Ballad of the Brain on My Shoe, a poem that resulted from Daisy's visit to the operating theatre one morning to watch her father at work. It's the one, of course, that Henry likes least. His daughter was present for a straightforward MCA aneurysm. No grey or white matter was lost. He thought he caught in the poem art's essential but he had to suppose, forgivable dishonesty. Daisy sent her grandfather an affectionate postcard. She told him how much she missed him, and how much she owed to him. She said his remarks thrilled her, and she was reading them over and again, and was giddy with his praise. Now the old man and Daisy are converging from Toulouse and Paris. A TV company wanting to make a programme about his life is putting Grammaticus up in style at Claridge's. At dinner tonight, the reconciliation will be sealed. This is the idea, but Perrone, lugging his bag of fish, moving with the crowds back down the high street, has shared too many meals with his father-in-law to be optimistic. And matters have moved on in the past 3 years. These days, Grammaticus starts his evenings or late afternoons the way he used to, with a few serious jolts of gin before the wine, a habit he managed to kick for a while in his 60s. Another development is the tumblers of scotch to round out the day before he visits the pre-bedtime cleansing beer. If he appears on the doorstep in a cheerful or excited state, he'll feel that unexamined compulsion of his to dominate in his daughter's house, which makes him drink faster. Becoming drunk is a journey that generally elates him in the early stages. He's good company, expansive, mischievous and fun, the famous old poet, almost as happy listening as talking. But once the destination is met, once established up there on that unsunny plateau, a fully qualified drunk, the nastier muses, the goblins of aggression, paranoia, self-pity take control. The expectation now is that an evening with John will go bad somehow, unless everyone around is prepared to toil at humouring and flattering and hours of frozen-faced listening. No one will be. Perrone reaches his car and stows his odorous bag in the boot in among the family's hiking boots and backpacks and last summer's tennis balls. The unprofessional thought sometimes occurs to him that the kindest touch for everyone, including the old man himself, would be to slip him a minor tranquilizer while he's still on the cheerful rising track. Some short-acting benzodiazepine derivative dissolved into a strong red wine like Rioja. And as his yawns multiply, guide him up the stairs to his room, or towards his taxi. The famous old poet in bed half an hour before midnight, tired and happy, and no harm done. He's driven a couple of hundred yards through Marylebone in slow-moving traffic when he notices in his rear-view mirror, two cars back, a red BMW. All he can actually see is a corner of its offside wing, and he can't tell whether the wing mirror is missing. A white van interposes itself at a junction and he can barely see the red car at all. It's not impossible that it's Baxter, but he feels no particular anxiety about seeing him again. In fact, he wouldn't mind talking to him. His case is interesting, and the offer of help was sincere. What concerns him more is that the Saturday morning traffic is no longer moving. There's an obstruction ahead. When he looks again, the red car has gone. And then he forgets about it. His attention is caught by a television shop to his left. In its window display are angled banks of identical images on various kinds of screen. Cathode ray, plasma, handheld, home cinema. What's showing on every device is the Prime Minister giving a studio interview. The close-up of a face is steadily becoming a close-up of a mouth, until the lips fill half the screen. He has suggested in the past that if we knew as much as he did, we too would want to go to war. Perhaps in this slow zoom, the director is consciously responding to a calculation a watching population is bound to want to make. Is this politician telling the truth? But can anyone really know the sign, the tell of an honest man? There's been some good work on this very question. Perrone has read Paul Ekman on the subject. In the smile of a self-conscious liar, certain muscle groups in the face are not activated. They only come to life as the expression of genuine feeling. The smile of a deceiver is flawed, insufficient. But can we see these muscles resting there inert when there's so much local variation in faces, pads of fat, odd concavities, differences of bone structure? Especially difficult when the first and best unconscious move of a dedicated liar is to persuade himself he's sincere. And once he's sincere, all deception vanishes. For all the difficulties, the instinctive countermeasures, we go on watching closely, trying to read a face, trying to measure intentions. Friend or foe, it's an ancient preoccupation. And even if down through the generations we are only right slightly more than half the time, it's still worth doing. More than ever now, on the edge of war, when the country still imagines it can call back this deed before it's too late. Does this man sincerely believe that going to war will make us safer? Does Saddam possess weapons of terrifying potential? Simply, the Prime Minister might be sincere and wrong. Some of his bitterest opponents don't doubt his good faith. He could be on the verge of a monstrous miscalculation. Or perhaps it will work out. The dictator vanquished without hundreds of thousands of deaths, and after a year or two a democracy at last, secular or Islamic, nestling among the weary tyrannies of the Middle East. Wedged in traffic alongside the multiple faces, Henry experiences his own ambivalence as a form of vertigo, of dizzy indecision. In neurosurgery, he chose a safe and simple profession. He knows of patients who can't even recognize, let alone read, the faces of their closest family or friends. In most cases, the right middle fusiform gyrus has been compromised, usually by a stroke. Nothing a neurosurgeon can do about that. And it must have been a moment of deficient face recognition, transient prosopagnosia, that was involved in his one meeting with Tony Blair. It was back in May 2000, a time now acquiring a polish, a fake gleam of innocence. Before the current preoccupations, there was a public project widely accounted a success. No one seemed to deny something went right. A disused power station on the south bank of the Thames was discovered to be useful as a museum for contemporary art. The conversion was bold and brilliant. At the opening party for the Tate Modern, there were 4,000 guests, celebrities, politicians, the great and good, and hundreds of young men and women distributing champagne and canapes, and a general euphoria untainted by cynicism, unusual at such events. Henry was there as a member of the Royal College of Surgeons. Rosalind was invited through her newspaper. Theo and Daisy came along too and vanished into the crowd as soon as they arrived. Their parents didn't see them until the following morning. The guests gathered in the industrial vastness of the old turbine hall, where the din of thousands of excited voices seemed to bear aloft a giant spider hovering below iron girders. After an hour, Henry and Rosalind broke away from their friends and wandered with their drinks among the exhibits through the relatively deserted galleries. Such was their well-being that even the sullen orthodoxies of conceptual art seemed part of the fun, like earnest displays of pupils' work at a school open day. Perrone liked Cornelia Parker's Exploding Shed, a humorous construction, like a brilliant idea bursting out of a mind. They came into a room of Rothko's and for several minutes remained pleasantly becalmed among the giant slabs of dusky purple and orange. Then they went through a wide portal into the gallery next door and came across what at first seemed like another installation. Part of it, a low pile of bricks, really was an exhibit. Standing beyond it, at the far end of the large room, was the Prime Minister, and at his side the gallery director. 20 feet away on the near side of the bricks, nominally restrained by a velvet rope, was the press corps, 30 photographers or more, and reporters, and what looked like gallery officials and Downing Street staff. The Perrones had come in on an oddly silent moment. Blair and the director smiled and posed for the cameras, whose pictures would also include the famous bricks. The flashes twinkled randomly, but none of the photographers was calling out in the usual way. The calmness of the scene seemed an extension of the Rothko gallery next door. Then the director, perhaps looking for an excuse to bring the session to an end, raised a hand in greeting to Rosalind. They knew each other through some legal matter that had ended amicably. The director guided Blair around the bricks and crossed the gallery towards the perrons, and behind them wheeled the retinue, the photographers with their cameras up and ready, the diarists with their notebooks in case something interesting should happen at last. Helplessly, the perrons watched them all approach. In a sudden press of bodies, they were introduced to the Prime Minister. He took Rosalind's hand first, then Henry's. The grip was firm and manly, and to Perrone's surprise, Blair was looking at him with recognition and interest. The gaze was intelligent and intense, and unexpectedly youthful. So much had yet to happen. He said, "I really admire the work you're doing." Perrone said automatically, "Thank you." But he was impressed. It was just conceivable, he supposed, that Blair, with his good memory and reputation for absorbing the details of his minister's briefs, would have heard of the hospital's excellent report last month, all targets met, and even of the special mention of the neurosurgery department's exceptional results. Procedures 23% up on last year. Later, Henry realized what an absurd notion that was. The Prime Minister, who still had hold of his hand, added, "In fact, we've got two of your paintings hanging in Downing Street. Sherry and I adore them." "No, no," Perrone said. "Yes, yes," the Prime Minister insisted, pumping his hand. He was in no mood for artistic modesty. "No, I think you, honestly, they're in the dining room." "You're making a mistake," Perrone said. And on that word there passed through the Prime Minister's features for the briefest instant a look of sudden alarm, of fleeting self-doubt. No one else saw his expression freeze and his eyes bulge minimally. A hairline fracture had appeared in the assurance of power. Then he continued as before, no doubt making the rapid calculation that given all the people pushing in around them trying to listen, there could be no turning back. Not without a derisive press tomorrow. "Anyway, they truly are marvellous. Congratulations." One of the aides, a woman in a black trouser suit, cut in and said, "Prime Minister, we have 3.5 minutes. We have to move." Blair let go of Perrone's hand and, without a farewell beyond a nod and a curt pursing of the lips, turned and let himself be led away. And the crew, the press, the flunkies, the bodyguards, the gallery underlings and their director surged behind him. And within seconds, the Perrones were standing in the empty gallery with the bricks, as if nothing had happened at all. Watching from his car the multiple images cutting between interviewer and guest, Perrone wonders if such moments, stabs of cold, panicky doubt, are an increasing part of the Prime Minister's days, or nights. There might not be a second UN resolution. The next weapons inspector's report could also be inconclusive. The Iraqis might use biological weapons against the invasion force. Or, as one former inspector keeps insisting, there might no longer be any weapons of mass destruction at all. There's talk of famine and 3 million refugees, and they're already preparing the reception camps in Syria and Iran. The UN is predicting hundreds of thousands of Iraqi deaths. There could be revenge attacks on London. And still the Americans remain vague about their post-war plans. Perhaps they have none. In all, Saddam could be overthrown at too high a cost. It's a future no one can read. Government ministers speak up loyally, various newspapers back the war. There's a fair degree of anxious support in the country along with the dissent. But no one really doubts that in Britain one man alone is driving the matter forward. Night sweats, hideous dreams, the wild, lurching fantasies of sleeplessness? Or simple loneliness? Whenever he sees him now on screen, Henry looks out for an awareness of the abyss, for that hairline crack, the moment of facial immobility, the brief faltering he privately witnessed. But all he sees is certainty, or at worst, a straining earnestness. He finds a vacant residence parking space across the road from his front door. As he takes the shopping from the boot of his car, he sees in the square, lounging by the bench nearest his house, the same young men who were often there in the early evening and then again late at night. There are two West Indians and two, sometimes three, Middle Easterners, who might be Turks. All of them look genial and prosperous, and frequently lean on each other's shoulders and laugh loudly. At the curb is a Mercedes, same model as Perrone's, but black, and a figure always at the wheel. Now and then a stranger will come by and stop to talk to the group. One of them will cross to the car, consult with the driver and return. There'll be another huddle, and then the stranger will walk on. They are entirely self-contained and unthreatening, and Perrone assumed for a long time they were dealers, running a pavement cafe in cocaine, perhaps, or ecstasy in marijuana. Their customers do not look haunted or degenerate enough to be heroin or crack users. It was Theo who put his father right. The group sells tickets for various fringe rap gigs around the city. They also sell bootleg CDs and can arrange cheap long-distance flights, as well as fix up cut-rate premises and DJs for parties, limos for weddings and airports, and cut-rate health and travel insurance. For a commission, they can introduce asylum seekers and illegal aliens to solicitors. The group pays no taxes or office overheads and is highly competitive. Whenever Perrone sees these people, he vaguely feels, as he does now, crossing the road to his door, that he owes them an apology. One day he'll buy something from them. Theo is down in the kitchen, probably preparing one of his fruit and yogurt breakfasts. Henry leaves the fish at the top of the stairs, calls down a greeting, and goes up to the second floor. The bedroom feels overheated and confined, and depleted by daylight. It looks and feels a better kind of place lit by dimmed lamps, with the day's work done and the promise of sleep. Being here in the early afternoon reminds him of a bad spell of flu. He pulls off his trainers, peels away his damp socks, and drops them in the laundry basket, and goes to the central window to open it. And there it is again, or another one, directly below him, slowly rounding the corner of the house where the street meets the square. His view is mostly of its roof, and his sightline to the offside wing mirror is entirely obscured, even though he pushes the window up and leans right out. Nor can he see the driver or any passengers. He watches it cruise along the northern side of the square and turn right into Conway Street and disappear. This time he doesn't feel quite so detached. But what is he then? Interested? Or even faintly troubled? It's a common enough make, and until 2 or 3 years ago, red was a common choice. On the other hand, why reason away the possibility of it being Baxter? His predicament is terrible and fascinating. The tough guy's street existence must have masked a longing for a better kind of life, even before the degenerative disease showed its first signs. Perrone comes away from the window and goes towards the bathroom. Baxter would hardly need to tail him. The Mercedes is distinctive enough, and it's parked right outside the house. Yes, he'd like to see Baxter again, in office hours, and hear more, and give him some useful contacts. But Henry doesn't want him hanging around the square. As he finishes undressing, his mobile rings from within the heap of clothes he's let fall at his feet. He fumbles and finds it. "Darling," she says. Rosalind at last. What better moment? He takes the phone through to the bedroom and sprawls naked on his back on the half-made bed where hours before they made love. From the radiators, he feels on his bare skin waves of heat like a desert breeze. The thermostat is set too high. He has a half, or perhaps really a quarter, of an erection. If she hadn't been working today, if there were no weekend crisis on the paper, if her mild-mannered editor wasn't such a bruiser when it comes to the small print of press freedom, she and Henry might be here together now. It's how they sometimes pass an hour or two on a winter's Saturday afternoon. The sexiness of a 4 o'clock dusk. The bathroom mirror, with the help of kindly illumination and a correct angle, allows Henry an occasional reminder of his youth. But Rosalind, by some trick of inner light or his own loving folly, still appears to resemble strongly, constantly, the woman he first knew all those years ago. The older sister of that young Rosalind, but not yet her mother. How long can this last? In their essentials, the individual elements remain unchanged. The near luminous pallor of her skin. Her mother, Marianne, was of Celtic descent. The scant, delicate eyebrows, almost non-existent. That level, soft green regard. And her teeth, white as ever. His own are going grey. The upper set perfectly shaped. The lower, faintly awry. A girlish imperfection he's never wanted her to remedy. The way the unfeigned breadth of the smile proceeds from a shy start. On her lips, an orange rose gleam that is all her own. The hair, cut short now, still reddish brown. In repose, she has an air of merry intelligence, an undiminished taste for fun. It remains a beautiful face. Like everyone in their 40s, she has her moments of dismay, weary before the mirror at bedtime, and he's recognised in himself that look, almost a snarl of savage appraisal. We're all travelling in the same direction. Reasonably, she's not entirely convinced when he tells her that the soft swelling at her hips is rather to his taste, as is the heaviness in her breasts. But it's true. Yes, he would be happy lying down with her now. He guesses that her state of mind will be remote from his own, in her black office clothes hurrying in and out of meetings, so he pulls himself up into a sitting position on the bed to talk sensibly. How's it going? Our judge is stuck in a traffic jam south of Blackfriars Bridge. It's the demonstration. But I think he's going to give us what we want.
Lift the injunction?
Yep. Monday morning.
She sounds speedy and pleased.
You're a genius, Henry says. What about your dad?
I can't collect him from his hotel. It's the demonstration. The traffic's hell. He's going to make his own way in a taxi.
She pauses and says at a slightly slower pace.
And how are you?
The downward inflection and extension of the final word is tender, a clear reference to this morning. He was wrong about her mood. He's about to tell her that he's naked on the bed, wanting her. Then he changes his mind. This isn't the time for telephone foreplay when he has to get out of the house and she has her own business to conclude. And there are more important things he's yet to tell her which will have to wait until after tonight's dinner, or tomorrow morning. He says, I'm heading off to Perivale as soon as I've had a shower. And because that isn't the answer to her question, he adds, I'm all right, but I'm looking forward to some time with you. That isn't enough either, so he says, various things have happened I need to talk to you about.
What sort of things?
Nothing terrible. I'd rather tell you when I see you.
Okay, but give me a clue.
Last night when I couldn't sleep, I was at the window. I saw that Russian cargo plane.
Darling, that must have been scary.
What else? He hesitates, and his hand, by its own volition, caresses the area around the bruise on his chest. What would be the heading, as she sometimes puts it? Road rage showdown? Attempted mugging? A neural disease? The wing mirror? The rear view mirror?
I lost at squash. I'm getting too old for this game.
She laughs.
I don't believe that's what it is.
but she sounds reassured. She says,
"There's something you may have forgotten. Theo's got a big rehearsal this afternoon. A few days ago I heard you promising to be there."
Damn! What time? He has no memory of such a promise.
"At 5, in that place in Ladbroke Grove."
I'd better move. He rises from the bed and takes the phone into the bathroom for the farewells. "I love you."
"I love you,"
she answers and rings off. He steps under the shower, a forceful cascade pumped down from the third floor. When this civilization falls, when the Romans, whoever they are this time round, have finally left and the new Dark Ages begin, this will be one of the first luxuries to go. The old folk crouching by their peat fires will tell their disbelieving grandchildren of standing naked midwinter under jet streams of hot, clean water, of lozenges of scented soaps, and of viscous amber and vermilion liquids they rubbed into their hair to make it glossy and more voluminous than it really was, and of thick white towels as big as togas waiting on warming racks. He wears a suit and tie 5 days a week. Today, he's wearing jeans, sweater and scuffed brown boots, and who's to know that he himself is not the great guitarist of his generation? As he bends to tie his laces, he feels a sharp pain in his knees. It's pointless holding out until he's 50. He'll give himself 6 more months of squash and 1 last London marathon. Will he be able to bear it, having these pastimes only in his past? At the mirror he's lavish with his aftershave. In winter especially, there's sometimes a scent in the air at the old people's home that he prefers to counteract. He steps out of the bedroom and then sideways on, skips down the first run of stairs, 2 at a time, without holding the banister for safety. It's a trick he learned in adolescence, and he can do it better than ever. But a skidding boot heel, a shattered coccyx, 6 months on his back in bed, a year rebuilding his wasted muscles. The premonitory fantasy fills less than half a second, and it works. He takes the next flight in the ordinary way. In the basement kitchen, Theo has already taken the fish and stowed it in the fridge. The tiny TV is on with muted sound and shows a helicopter's view of Hyde Park. The massed crowds appear as a smear of brown, like lichen on a rock. Theo has constructed his breakfast in a large salad bowl which contains close to a kilo of oatmeal, bran, nuts, blueberries, loganberries, raisins, milk, yogurt, chopped dates, apple and bananas. Theo nods at it. "Want some?" "I'll eat leftovers." Henry takes a plate of chicken and boiled potatoes from the fridge and eats standing up. His son sits on a high stool at the centre island, hunched over his giant bowl. Beyond the debris of crumbs, wrappers and fruit skins are pages of music manuscript with chords written out in pencil. His shoulders are broad, and the bunched muscles stretches the fabric of his clean white T-shirt. The hair, the skin of his bare arms, the thick, dark brown eyebrows still have the same rich, smooth, new-made quality Perrone used to admire when Theo was 4. Perrone gestures towards the TV. "Still not tempted?" "I've been watching. 2 million people. Truly amazing." Naturally, Theo is against the war in Iraq. His attitude is as strong and pure as his bones and skin. So strong he doesn't feel much need to go tramping through the streets to make his point. "What's the latest on that plane? I heard about the arrests." "No one's saying anything." Theo tips more milk into his salad bowl. "But there are rumours on the internet." "About the Quran?" "The pilots are radical Islamists. One's a Chechen, the other's Algerian." Perrone pulls up a stool and as he sits feels his appetite fading. He pushes his plate aside. "So, how does it work? They set fire to their own plane in the cause of jihad, then land safely at Heathrow?"
They bottled out.
So their idea was to sort of join in today's demonstration?
Yeah. They'd be making a point. Make war on an Arab nation and this is the kind of thing that's going to happen.
It doesn't sound plausible. But in general, the human disposition is to believe, and when proved wrong, shift ground. Or have faith and go on believing. Over time, down through the generations, this may have been the most efficient. Just in case, believe. All day, Perrone himself has suspected the story was not all it seemed, and now Theo is feeding this longing his father has to hear the worst. On the other hand, if the rumours about the plane come from the internet, the chances of their inaccuracy are increased. Henry gives a condensed account of his scrape with Baxter and his friends, and of the symptoms of Huntington's and the lucky escape. Theo says,
"You humiliated him. You should watch that."
"Meaning what?"
"These street guys can be proud. Also, Dad, I can't believe we've lived here all this time and you and Mum had never been mugged."
Perrone looks at his watch and stands.
"Mum and I just don't have the time. I'll see you in Notting Hill around 5.
"You're coming?"
"Excellent."
It is part of Theo's charm not to have pressed him. And if his father hadn't shown up, he wouldn't have mentioned it.
"Start without me, you know what it's like getting from Granny's. We'll be doing the new song. Chaz will be there. We'll keep it till you arrive."
Chaz is his favourite among Theo's friends, and the most educated too, dropping out of an English degree in his 3rd year at Leeds to play in a band. A wonder that life so far. Suicidal mother, absent father, 2 brothers, members of a strict Baptist sect, hasn't crushed all that relaxed good nature out of him. Something about the name of St. Kitts, Saints, Kids, Kittens, has produced a profusion of kindness in one giant lad. Since meeting him, Perrone has developed a vague ambition to visit the island. From a corner of the room, he picks up a potted plant wrapped in tissue, an expensive orchid he bought a few days ago in the florist's by Heels. He stops at the doorway and raises a hand in farewell.
"I'm cooking tonight. Don't forget to straighten out the kitchen."
"Yeah."
Then Theo adds without irony,
"Remember me to Granny. Give her my love."
Clean and scented, with a dull, near-pleasurable ache in his limbs driving west in light traffic, Perrone finds he's feeling better about seeing his mother. He knows the routine well enough. Once they're established together face-to-face with their cups of dark brown tea, the tragedy of her situation will be obscured behind the banality of detail, of managing the suffocating minutes, of inattentive listening. Being with her isn't so difficult. The hard part is when he comes away before this visit merges in memory with all the rest. When the woman she once was haunts him as he stands by the front door and leans down to kiss her goodbye. That's when he feels he's betraying her, leaving her behind in her shrunken life, sneaking away to the riches, the secret hoard of his own existence. Despite the guilt, he can't deny the little lift he feels, the lightness in his step when he turns his back and walks away from the old people's place and takes his car keys from his pocket and embraces the freedoms that can't be hers. Everything she has now fits into her tiny room. And she hardly possesses the room because she's incapable of finding it unaided or even of knowing that she has one. And when she is in it, she doesn't recognise her things. It's no longer possible to bring her to the square to stay or take her on excursions. A small journey disorients or even terrifies her. She has to remain behind, and naturally, she doesn't understand that either. But the thought of leave-taking ahead doesn't trouble him now. He's at last suffused by the mild euphoria that follows exercise. That blessed self-made opiate, beta-endorphin, smothering every kind of pain. There's a merry Scarlatti harpsichord on the radio, tinkling through a progression of chords that never quite resolves and seems to lead him on towards a playfully receding destination. In the rearview mirror, no red BMW. Along this stretch, where the Euston becomes the Marylebone Road, the traffic signals are phased Manhattan-style, and he's wafted forwards on a leading edge of green lights, a surfer on a perfect wave of simple information. Go! Or even, yes! The long line of tourists, teenagers mostly outside Madame Tussaud's, seems less futile than usual. A generation raised on thunderous Hollywood effects still longs to stand and gawp at waxworks, like 18th-century peasants at a country fair. The reviled Westway rearing on stained concrete piles and on which he rises swiftly to second-floor level offers up a sudden horizon of tumbling cloud above a tumult of rooftops. It's one of those moments when to be a car owner in a city, the owner of this car, is sweet. For the first time in weeks, he's in fourth gear. Perhaps he'll make fifth. A sign on a gantry above the traffic lanes proclaims, "The West, the North." As though there lies, spread beyond the suburbs, a whole continent and the promise of a six-day journey. The traffic must be stalled somewhere else by the march. For almost half a mile, he alone possesses this stretch of elevated road. For seconds on end, he thinks he grasps the vision of its creators. A purer world that favours machines rather than people. A rectilinear curve sweeps him past recent office buildings of glass and steel, where the lights are already on in the February early afternoon. He glimpses people as neat as architectural models at their desks before their screens, even on a Saturday. This is the tidy future of his childhood science fiction comics, of men and women with tight-fitting collarless jumpsuits, no pockets, trailing laces or untucked shirts, living a life beyond litter and confusion, free of clutter to fight evil. But from a vantage point on the White City flyover, just before the road comes down to earth among rows of red brick housing, he sees the tail lights massing ahead and begins to brake. His mother never minded traffic lights and long delays. Only a year ago she was still well enough, forgetful, vague, but not terrified, to enjoy being driven around the streets of West London. The lights gave her an opportunity to examine other drivers and their passengers. "Look at him! He's got a spotty face!" Or simply to say companionably, "Red again!" She was a woman who gave her life to housework, to the kind of daily routines of polishing, dusting, vacuuming and tidying that were once common, and these days are only undertaken by patients with obsessive-compulsive disorders. Every day while Henry was at school, she spring-cleaned her house. She drew her deepest satisfactions from a tray of well-roasted beef, the sheen on a nest of tables, a pile of ironed, candy-striped sheets folded in smooth slabs, a larder of neat provisions. Or from one more knitted matinee jacket for one more baby in the remoter reaches of the family. The invisible sides, the obverse, the underneath and the insides of everything were clean. The oven and its racks were scrubbed after every use. Order and cleanliness were the outward expression of an unspoken ideal of love. A book he was reading would be back on the hallway shelf upstairs as soon as he put it aside. The morning paper could be in the dustbin by lunchtime. The empty milk bottles she put out for collection were as clean as her cutlery. To every item, its drawer or shelf or hook, including her various aprons and her yellow rubber gloves held by a clothes peg hanging near the egg-shaped egg timer. Surely it was because of her that Henry feels at home in an operating theatre. She too would have liked the waxed black floor, the instruments of surgical steel arrayed in parallel rows on a sterile tray, and the scrub room with its devotional routines. She would have admired the niceties, the clean headwear, the short fingernails. He should have had her in while she was still capable. It never crossed his mind. It never occurred to him that his work, his 15 years' training, had anything to do with what she did. Nor did it occur to her. He barely knew it at the time, but he grew up thinking her intelligence was limited. He used to think she was without curiosity, but that wasn't right. She liked a good exploratory heart-to-heart with her neighbours. The 8-year-old Henry liked to flop on the floor behind the furniture and listen in. Illness and operations were important subjects, especially those associated with childbirth. That was when he first heard the phrase "under the knife" as well as "under the doctor." What the doctor said was a powerful invocation. This eavesdropping may have set Henry on his career. Then there were running accounts of infidelities or rumours of them, and ungrateful children, and the unreasonableness of the old, and what someone's parent left in a will, and how a certain nice girl couldn't find a decent husband. Good people had to be sifted from the bad, and it wasn't always easy to tell at first which was which. Indifferently, illness struck the good as well as the bad. Later, when he made his dutiful attempts on Daisy's undergraduate course in the 19th-century novel, he recognised all his mother's themes. There was nothing small-minded about her interests. Jane Austen and George Eliot shared them too. Lillian Perrone wasn't stupid or trivial. Her life wasn't unfortunate, and he had no business as a young man being condescending towards her. But it's too late for apologies now. Unlike in Daisy's novels, moments of precise reckoning are rare in real life. Questions of misinterpretation are not often resolved, nor do they remain pressingly unresolved. They simply fade. People don't remember clearly, or they die, or the questions die, and new ones take their place. Besides, Lily had another life that no one could have predicted or could remotely guess at now. She was a swimmer. On Sunday morning, September the 3rd, 1939, while Chamberlain was announcing in his radio broadcast from Downing Street that the country was at war with Germany, the 14-year-old Lily was at a municipal pool near Wembley, having her first lesson with a 60-year-old international athlete who had swum for Britain in the Stockholm Olympics in 1912, the first ever women's swimming event. She had spotted Lily in the pool and offered to give her lessons for free, and coached her in the crawl, a most unladylike stroke. Lily went in for local matches in the late 40s. In 1954, she swam for Middlesex in the county championships. She came second, and her tiny silver medal set on a wooden shield made of oak always stood on the mantelpiece while Henry was growing up. It's on a shelf in her room now. That silver was as far or as high as she got, but she always swam beautifully, fast enough to push out in front of her a deep and sinuous bow wave. She taught Henry, of course, but his treasured memory of her swimming was of when he was 10 on a school visit one morning to the local pool. He and his friends were changed and ready, had been through the shower and foot bath, and had to wait on the tiles for the adult session to end. Two teachers stood by, shushing and fussing, trying to contain the children's excitement. Soon, there was only one figure remaining in the pool, one in a white rubber cap with a frieze of petals he should have recognised earlier. His whole class was admiring her speed as she surged up the lane, the furrow in the water she left behind just at the small of her back, and the way she turned her head to breathe without breaking her line in the water. When he knew it was her, he convinced himself he'd known from the beginning. To add to his exultation, he didn't even have to claim her out loud. Someone called out, "That's Mrs. Perrone!" In silence, they watched as she reached the end of her lane right at their feet and performed a flashy underwater turn that was novel at the time. This was no mere duster of sideboards. He'd seen her swim often enough, but this was entirely different.
All his friends were there to witness her superhuman nature in which he shared. Surely she knew, and put on in the last half-length a show of demonic speed just for him. Her feet churned, her slender white arms rose and chopped at the water, her bow waves swelled, the furrow deepened. Her body shaped itself round her own wave in a shallow, undulating S. You would have had to sprint along the pool to keep up with her. She stopped at the far end and stood and put her hands on the edge and flipped herself out of the water. She would have been about 40 then. She sat there, feet still immersed, pulled off her cap and, tilting her head, smiled shyly in their direction. One of the teachers led the kids into solemn applause.
Though it was 1966, the boys' hair was growing thickly over their ears, the girls wore jeans to class. A degree of 50s formality still prevailed. Henry clapped with the rest. But when his friends gathered round, he was too choked with pride, too exhilarated to answer their questions, and was relieved to get in the pool where he could conceal his feelings. In the 20s and 30s, great tracts of agricultural land to the west of London disappeared before an onslaught of high-speed housing development. And even now, the streets of frowning, respectable two-story houses haven't quite shaken off their air of suddenness. Each near-identical house has an uneasy provisional look, as if it knows how readily the land would revert to cereal crops and grazing. Lily now lives only a few minutes away from the old Perry Vale family home. Henry likes to think that in the misty landscape of her dementia, a sense of familiarity breaks through occasionally and reassures her. By the standards of old people's homes, Suffolk Place is minute. Three houses have been knocked through to make one, and an annex has been added. Out front, privet hedges still mark the old garden boundaries and two laburnum trees survive. One of the three front gardens has been cemented over to make parking space for two cars. The oversized dustbins behind a lattice fence are the only institutional clues. Perrone parks and takes the potted plant from the back seat. He pauses a moment before ringing the bell. There's a taste in the air, sweet and vaguely antiseptic, that reminds him of his teenage years in these streets, and of a general state of longing, a hunger for life to begin that from this distance seems like happiness. As usual, Jenny opens the door. She's a large, cheerful Irish girl in a blue gingham tabard who's due to start nurses' training in September. Henry receives special consideration on account of his medical connection, an extra 3 tea bags in the brew she'll bring soon to his mother's room, and perhaps a plate of chocolate fingers. Without knowing much at all about each other, they've settled on teasing forms of address.
If it isn't the good doctor.
How's my fair Colleen? Off the narrow space of the suburban hallway, tinted yellow by the front door's leaded glass, is a kitchen of fluorescent light and stainless steel. From there comes a clammy aroma of the lunch the residents ate 2 hours earlier. After a lifetime's exposure, Perrone has a mild fondness, or at least a complete lack of disgust, for institutional food. On the other side of the entrance hall is a narrower door that leads through into the three interconnecting sitting rooms of three houses. He can hear the bottled sound of televisions in other rooms.
"She's waiting for you,"
Jenny says. They both know this to be a neurological impossibility. Even boredom is beyond his mother's reach.
This ends Disc 5.